Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, and of course, you lurking conservatives, I'm reading your emails. You have no argument anymore, man. George Bush is going down, the GOP is going down, Dick Cheney is going down, and you guys can do nothing but flail, and it's so appealing to me. I know I'm supposed to be a little more diplomatic than that, but I'm not Mark Riley. I'm not gonna. I'm gonna relish in the schadenfreude, the justice of the GOP flailing about. Even if the Democrats don't have a platform quite together, that they're not all on the same page, that's fine with me as long as the Republicans continue to fragment.
Well, I mean, why be diplomatic? Dick Cheney's not being.
That's right, man. We're gonna tear him one today. But let's start off. I want to thank all the I want to thank people. You know, in my audience, in our audience, Mark Riley and Chris and Brendan and little Goliath, we have a lot of supportive people. And as you know, I did have a slip yesterday on the meet or over the weekend. I slipped on the meet, and it touches my heart that listeners are concerned about my personal plight. And I'd like to read this. From a listener named Peter, who, you know, when I read this, I really realized that there are a lot of good people out there. Mark, what's up with this silly vegetarianism? You know your heart's not in it. What are you trying to prove? Is somebody pressuring you, or are you on a self-imposed mind? You know you want a cheeseburger. Now, this is where he shifts into, like, you know, satanic non-vegetarian guys. Like, you know you want a cheeseburger, steak, nice prime rib. Just like you'd treat yourself to after a show on the road. How about some lamb chops, for Christ's sake?
Oh, God.
Chicken sandwich with mayo and white toast, or even a club sandwich. Afraid you won't go to liberal heaven? If this is for animals or the environment, trust me, little old you can't make a difference. And as far as some fear of hypocrisy, you're already a hypocrite because you can't stop talking / thinking about meat. If it's for your health, it's counterproductive. You're getting more injurious and anxiety by trying to do something that's making you tense and unhappy. And right now, you need as much happiness as you can garner. Life is short. There's sex, movies, reading, friendship, family, and food. Are you putting on an act? Have a steak tonight and send me the bill. It's on me. No kidding. Peter. Thank you, Peter. You know what? I am going to have a steak on you, Peter. I buckle. I'm over it. I'm done with it. I am so sick of fish, I can't begin to tell you how sick of fish I'm. I resent seeing fish in pet stores. I hate them. I hate fish. It's not the same when I go to Marino's anymore. I don't have the same chipper disposition over at Marino's and Sons Fish Market on 30th Avenue in Astoria, who's been treating me with monkfish and scallops. I walk in there, and I used to be like, hey, fellas, what do you got for me today? Now it's like, all right, what kind of fish can I eat that I haven't eaten yet? Help me out here. I'm turning into a thermometer. You can tell what temperature it is by looking at the color of my face. That's how much mercury I'm sitting on right now. I can't take it anymore. All right, well, maybe I won't do it tonight. But, Peter, I think I am slipping. I don't know. At least, maybe I'm just rationalizing. Maybe I'm just making it okay for me to eat turkey on Thanksgiving. Is there anything wrong with that? Because I got to cook it for 14 people. I'm leaving today, Riley. You're on your own tomorrow. You don't have a problem with that, right?
Wait a minute. You're going to Florida tomorrow?
I'm going to Florida today.
Oh, you're going to Florida today.
But, you know, I know that you're going to be gone the week after Thanksgiving, so I'm not going to feel so bad about it. But I'm going today. I'm going to see my mommy today, and I know what's going to happen. She's going to be like, you look good. I don't know about the beard because it makes your face look fat. That's what I'm going to go
to. Just like a homeless person.
I don't look like a homeless person.
No, a little bit, actually.
What do you look like a dumb little Italian man. What do you want from me? I'm a homeless person. What are you to talk about anything? At least that means that I have some renegade individuality running through my disposition. You, on the other hand, what are you? Just like this crew-cutted little Italian man.
Jesse and I were looking at you in the studio and like, wow, he looks quite homeless today.
quite homeless. Come on. Hey, look. Today is the 42nd anniversary of the Kennedy assassination. John F. Kennedy, President John F. Kennedy, was shot in Dealey Plaza from the Book Depository and the Grassy Knoll, and perhaps from a satellite up above from several different angles. I don't want to trivialize this because I was not alive for it. I know there's
Yes, you were.
I was 2 months old.
Yeah, but you were alive.
Yes, I was alive. I wonder if that had anything to do with my early development, because I know that my mother loved John F. Kennedy, like much of the country, and there I was, a little two-month-old baby, and this is something, this is an event not unlike 9/11, I believe, because of the intimacy of the media at that point in time, that threw the world into a shock and grief that had never been felt before, I think, on a collective basis.
Well, certainly never been felt through the medium of television mm-hmm. before. This was one of the first big events, sad to say, but one of the first big events that television covered. Of course, just before that, a couple of years before that, there had been the debate between Nixon and Kennedy. That was a big watershed event. And then the Kennedy assassination was Walter Cronkite, the man that everyone looked to for news as the authority, started crying as he was covering this. I was in junior high school at the time. I'm a little older than you.
Yeah.
And I was in the seventh grade, and we were running down the hall. And suddenly, you know, over the loudspeaker came, attention, please, attention, please. We received word from Dallas, Texas, that President Kennedy has been shot. Now, the initial thing was that he had been shot. It wasn't like he had been shot and he's dead.
Right.
There was just the initial, like, and, you know, people literally froze in the hallway. I mean, teachers, students, everybody. Because Kennedy represented a very specific thing, I think, to people who grew up in the early 1960s. This whole promise, this hope that the civil rights movement was going to work well, the hope that the country, you know, had come together around being Americans, you know, a young, vibrant president. And suddenly to get have him cut down like that was just a tremendous shock. And one of a series of shocks that took place during the 1960s, including the assassination of his brother Robert, the assassination of Martin King. And, you know, all of that idealism that people went into the decade with was thoroughly done by the end of the 60s.
Sacrificed on the altar of television. Bloody, bloody sacrifices of all that idealism.
Yeah.
And in 42 years of speculation now as to, you know, who was really involved, what are the forces that brought it on. I, of course, am of the belief that George H.W. Bush was on the grassy knoll. I believe that to be true, at least in spirit. He was in the area. There's a, I don't even want to go into the independent speculative investigation of the Kennedy assassination. Some people are still working on it. If you are someone who survived, who remembers that day and the impact it had on you emotionally, I mean, Lou Reed wrote a song called "The Day John Kennedy Died," which was for Lou Reed just incredibly moving, just about the moment that sort of time stopped and the grief that the world felt at that moment. If you have any recollection of that or anything you can compare it to, and describe to me, someone who doesn't remember it, I'd appreciate your call, 866-303-2270. My brain's a little crazy today. Who's this on the phone right here? Should I take it? Cole in Missouri? How are you, Cole? What's going on?
What's up, Cole?
Cole?
Oh, there he is.
Listen, man, I got to know somebody out there is carrying the torch and staying a vegetarian. I'm a battling vegetarian. All my friends eat meat. They all think I'm crazy.
Yeah.
I got to know somebody out there is trying for me. You're hurt me, Mark.
Cole.
I know you felt... What?
I'll try, man. I didn't realize. I'll try. I'll do it for you, buddy. Are you eating fish?
Well, let me tell you. I had a ribeye. I go to the store, right? I get to my friend's house. They're all cooking steaks.
Yeah.
I go buy a $14 pound-and-a-half ribeye and ate it.
Uh-huh.
First time I've had a steak in a long time. And I'll tell you what, it was real good.
Yeah.
But like you're saying with the fish, you feel like you're a thermometer with the mercury. Your body's trying to tell you something, man. Fish is dirty, too. The
best thing about dirty fish.
But boy, you're going to eat meat. It's cool to eat some meat. Just get the free-range chicken and the organic beef and go that way. You can do it. I mean, I don't think meat is that bad.
Yeah, I want the meat that is talked nice to while it kills it. You know what I mean? Like...
Yeah, they just sort of slowly tickle it to death or something.
Tickle it to death. Or right at the moment, I have this idea that there's actually meat available, I think, from Japan, where they actually are, they erotically asphyxiate the cow at the moment of orgasm. And it's very expensive, but I hear it's great. It's only fed, beautiful organic grain, and it dies at the peak of climax. So maybe I should just look for that.
I'm sure that's cheap, too.
It's got to be expensive.
Well, I won't keep you guys too long. I know you guys got a lot of things to talk about. Mark, of course, you know we're all supporting you. And
yeah.
You, Riley, we love the show. We don't want anything to change. But, man, I'm telling you, the vegetarian thing, have some turkey. Enjoy it. Don't feel guilty. Don't feel guilty, because I know that you have the guilt, and it's okay.
Uh-huh.
You know, don't feel guilty. Eat the natural meat.
Okay.
And do what your body tells you. If your body tells you it's too much fish, you know, you don't have to eat fish.
Okay, all right. Well,
there you go.
Thank you very much, Cole. Thank you for forgiving
Design
me.
For living.
That's great. I feel so much better. So, look, in a second, why don't we talk about Bush's secret plan to bomb Al Jazeera? 15 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition.
It's just a wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. It is the 42nd anniversary of the death of John F. Kennedy, the assassination of John F. Kennedy. We are rolling a couple calls here on reflections on that day. I was not cognizant. I was 2 months old, and I wanted somebody to tell me their experience. So we got a few calls on the phone before we get to them. According to the British paper, The Daily Mirror, George Bush and company planned to bomb Al Jazeera. There's a Downing Street memo that of a conversation between Bush and Tony Blair about launching a military strike on the station. Blair talked him down because, bottom line, Al Jazeera's headquarters is in Qatar, an ally in the densely populated business district in Doha. Blair today or yesterday offered no comment on the story. Another British paper, The Mirror, said it would have been the most spectacular foreign policy disaster since the war itself. Now, Riley, this is not an uncommon tactic in warfare to bomb a propaganda ministry or to bomb an outlet or a newspaper or something like that, but not this. This would be like if they were to bomb Fox News here in New York.
Well, yeah. I mean, usually if you're going to bomb a propaganda ministry, it's in the country of the, you know, that you're fighting.
Yes.
Not an ally who is apparently your friend. And you want to, you know, you want to get rid of this particular out. By the way, Al Jazeera has offices in D.C. They gonna bomb them too?
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
Where else are they gonna bomb around the world? Do they figure that by hitting Al Jazeera in Qatar, there'd be no other problems?
Oh no. Well, I think Blair was right. There would have been reprisals. And now, you know, Blair, they're trying to push it off. It's like, hey, Bush was just joking.
Yeah, right.
Given the failure of the SUV line that GM tried to push last year, as opposed to try to retool the business after a corporate mistake in that speculation around SUVs, as far as reading the market is concerned, GM is going to lay off 30,000 people and close 9 North American plants by 2008. This is about 9% of their total workforce, Riley. That's 325,000 because something that the corporate executives decided backfired. So now they're going to lay these people off. They're going to try to cut $7 billion in costs. Cuts will come from attrition. There will be early retirement. The United Autos Workers Union is trying to negotiate a plan around this. You know, it's weird, Riley. We had a conversation about cars last week, and we got a couple of letters from guys in the auto union who said, why are you guys talking about Japanese cars? And this is interesting because one of the union leaders said around this cut, quote, they need to design cars that sell to be successful, end quote. And that's exactly the conversation we had, is that, hey, I would buy an American car in a second if any of them could make the top 10 list on Consumer Reports, if any of them would save money, if any of them were well built. I like the new Mustangs, but they feel like they're made out of crap.
Well, the problem the GM in particular had was a disastrous strategy to build their profits on what are obviously very profitable SUVs, the Cadillac Escalade. Those kinds of trucks make a bunch of money for GM, and that's who this guy Wagner,
yeah,
that made the announcement. That was his contribution to all this.
Right.
He decided, well, we'll downsize, or we won't really pay that much attention to building hybrid vehicles. We will build these gigantic, monstrous SUVs. And by the time they got them to market, the price of gas was so high that they were sitting on people's auto showroom floors or in the lots where they keep these things because nobody wanted to buy them at that.
Well, that was a mistake on behalf of the corporate leadership. Why don't those guys go down?
It was his decision.
He should go down. I mean, not these 30,000 people. That's ridiculous. You can't just ruin people's lives because somebody made a mistake in a speculation. It happens all the time, but it's absolutely wrong. They should design some cars that people will want to buy. They should make the quality as to what it is coming out of a Prius or a Toyota. And I know a lot of United States auto workers would say they are, but I just haven't seen it. I would, if you write me an email at Sedition and Air America Radio to test drive a car this week, an American-made car, I can get an auto worker, send me an email of a car you believe in that will give me good gas mileage and is well built.
I know which one they're going to tell you right off the top.
What?
The Chevy Cobalt.
All right, well, I'll go test drive one if that's it. Sedition at AirAmericaRadio.com. Let's take a couple of calls on the, you know, reflecting on the assassination of John F. Kennedy. It is the 42nd anniversary of that horrendous day today. Pat, a trucker out in Denver, how are you?
Hey, Pat.
I'm doing pretty good.
I guess Mark Riley and I are the same age because I was in junior high too when that happened.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I was living in San Diego at the time, and it was lunchtime, and I walked into the cafeteria, and our principal was up on the stage listening to the radio.
Yeah.
And I asked him who was winning because I thought he was listening to a ball game, and he was gave me this real weird look. And I got in line, and I was teasing this girl, and she turned around, she was crying.
Yeah.
And she goes, "How could you joke when the president's been shot?" Well, I was just about ready to come up with some wise comment.
Yeah.
But that's when the bulletin came over the radio that he was dead.
Wow.
And it was like the rug had been jerked out under my feet. But to make matters worse, my birthday is November 24th.
Oh.
And everybody was trying to, you know, I mean, we were walking around just all in shock.
Yeah.
And they were trying to do something for my birthday, but it just didn't feel right. And then, of course, to make matters worse, Oswald was shot that morning, you know.
Wow.
And but it was like, it was weird. It was like, you know, that song, The End of the Age of Innocence. That's the way it felt.
Did you see?
I was only 12, and I could comprehend what was going on.
Yeah. Of course, 12 years old.
I was exactly the same age, 12 years old.
Did you see Oswald get shot on television?
I don't really remember. They showed it all day long, so I mean,
I saw it. I saw it live.
Yeah.
Like, you know. It was, let me tell you something. The first thing that some people were saying was that the Russians killed Kennedy.
Right.
I mean, I remember hearing that as a kid, you know, some of the teachers saying, the Russians got him, the Russians got him. And then when it turned out that Oswald had spent time in the Soviet Union and was married to a Russian woman, the paranoia just like went through the roof.
So, Pat,
it was about a year earlier we were going through the Cuban crisis.
Exactly.
So Pat, that question about who's winning wasn't so off base.
Yeah, right?
So, hey, Pat, yeah. Have a happy birthday, man.
Have a happy birthday, okay. Pat.
Thanks a lot.
I appreciate it.
Take care.
Take care now.
Okay, bye-bye. Let's take some more of these calls. These are kind of interesting. It's sort of like time travel, you know, because all my recollections around this are either from reading books or seeing pictures or seeing the Zapruder film 900 times in order to try to assess what happened with some other conspiracy theorists. I mean, independent speculative investigators.
There you go.
But I would like to hear the emotions, because even with Pat's call, I felt that same emotion coming up about, you know, like how I felt on 9/11, that complete discombobulation, that complete sort of planet shift of international grief and shock. 27 past the hour, 866-303-2270 is our number.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Four past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program on Tuesday. I hope you're having a good morning. I'm getting a few emails here from people responding to my reaching out for an American car that is quality and good and one that I should test drive. One of the emails I got, I think, sounds very appealing. Mark, no longer own an automobile. Come to Switzerland and test drive the Swiss railways. In conjunction with the trams and buses, there's no need for a car in Western Europe. Dude, you don't know how good that sounds right now. Mark, I own a regular Escape and bought it before the hybrid came out. I would buy a hybrid Escape if I were in the market for a new vehicle. Also drove the new Mustang 5-speed, and the car goes. It was very cool. I do like the way those Mustangs look. Here's what I'm going to do right now. I'm going to do the iNews, and then I'm going to take a call from a guy who was in Dallas during when the Kennedy assassination happened. Today is the 42nd anniversary of the Kennedy assassination. We're sort of rolling calls throughout the day of people's personal recollections about that day to share those with me at 866-303-2270. Riley and I, but Riley kind of remembers it. I was not cognizant, or I was only 2 months old. And then we're going to get into to Tom DeLay's former spokesman and Jack Abramoff's business partner, Michael Scanlon, has made a plea bargain, and a representative from Ohio, Representative Nye, I never know how to pronounce his name. I'm going to go with Nye.
How about jail?
Jail.
Representative Jail.
Representative Jail. He's in deep trouble, but this is just the beginning of a domino effect. We're going to get that going in a minute. We've also got a gentleman on later in the show, Martin Smith, he's a frontline correspondent, and we have fragments. We have segments, partial, what do you call them? Sound bites from a Michael Brown interview that was done. It's the first interview he's done since he made the horrendous mistakes that he made during the Katrina disaster. So that's the menu. Okay, he's later in the show, but we're going to do the iNews, talk to the guy from Dallas, and then talk about Michael Scanlon. And then after that, we're going to talk about Iraq and the Democrats and the Republicans falling apart. How's that for a menu? Sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So luckily, we have an iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. Let's crank this up and feed it some headlines. Here we go. Yes. All right. How is that still funny? From Seattle Times, Bush cools war debate, calls Murtha a fine man. Bush cools war debate, calls Murtha a fine man. Translation, Bush thrown from swift boat. I don't know why that's funny, but I thought it was funny.
It's clever.
It's clever. Clearly, I was the only one. All right, from Associated Press, CIA director, unique methods, not tortured. Not torture. CIA director, unique methods, not torture. Translation, CIA director, waterboards, English language. Again, clever.
Waterboarding's always funny.
Yeah, waterboarding's funny. It's funny, but not as fun as snowboarding. All right.
So when did we turn into Paul Schaefer?
I don't know.
That's funny. That's a good idea.
Yeah, about a year ago. Or so. All right, wait. I like this one here. Let's do another one of that. CIA director, unique methods, not tortured. Here's another translation that just came out of the machine, I think. Yeah, there it is. CIA director, unique methods, not torture. CIA on the cutting edge. Wait. CIA on the cutting, punching, and electronic edge of torture technology. From the Seattle Times, new Xbox goes on sale. Tonight. New Xbox goes on sale tonight. There's no way you cannot know that. They're hitting you from all angles with that Xbox. In translation, video game addicts make rare trip outdoors. Everywhere, man. Xbox 360. I don't even know what it does. I don't know what.
Me
I don't know
neither.
What,
I have no clue.
I don't know what the old one does. I think I bought my wife one a few years ago. Not as a PlayStation.
It plays video games, doesn't it?
Yeah, listen to you, like old guy. Me too. It's like, does it do something with a button?
No, but you know,
it's a button and a thing. It makes noises.
No, this new thing. Gates has got some way to make this interactive with everything else he's got. That's little
the big
portal
thing. That's why it's everywhere. I was sleeping last night. I saw a commercial for the Xbox 360 in my sleep. That's what Gates has, man. If you got Microsoft on your computer, man, watch out. The messages are coming down. They're bleeding into your subconscious, man. It was only a matter of time, dude. I'm hearing one now. It's telling me to shut up. I can't. I'm on a radio show. Let's take this call. 42nd anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. We're going to switch tones here. Ronnie is calling from Los Angeles. He was in Dallas. Good morning, Ronnie.
It's Romy.
Romy, I'm sorry, buddy.
How you doing, Romy?
How are you?
Hello, Mark and Mark.
Hi.
Yes, I was in Dallas. I was standing in front of Neiman Marcus.
Ah, so you were watching the parade?
Yes, I was. Actually, I was not only watching the parade, I was kind of like reporting on it for my school.
Wow. How old were you?
16.
Wow, so how close were you? What did you see that day?
Well, I saw very clearly. I saw the whole parade. I saw, I used to have my notes that I made that day. I was with my mom and dad.
Yeah.
All of us, many people in the African-American community turned out that day because, of course, they all wanted to see Kennedy.
Yeah. He's a very popular guy in the black community. That's
right,
true.
Exactly. So you didn't have to go to school, and I was with my parents.
Wow.
Standing in front of Neiman Marcus and making notes about how the pink suit Miss Kennedy had on and the gray suit that JFK had on, et cetera, et cetera.
So you saw them drive by, and then I guess after
3 minutes later.
Oh my God! So
how did you find out? Did your parents have a radio or something?
Somebody in the crowd. It was a huge crowd, of course.
Right. So it just rippled.
Someone in the crowd said something about the president's been shot, and then like the whole group just folded into the streets.
Oh my God, that's unbelievable! So everybody, it was just chaos and shock.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And how long did it take for things to get back to normal there in Dallas in some level?
Well, I think that there were two things. Let me be clear. There were two things going on here.
Mm-hmm.
there were some folks who were cheering. There's a tape, and I don't know where there were some people who cheered about Kennedy being killed.
Mm. I heard that too. I didn't know it was true, but I had heard.
Yeah, that's actually true. In some of the schools in the white community, people cheered.
Mm.
I went back to school that afternoon, and of course, everybody was sad, and we were immediately dismissed. I think I got back to school about 2 o'clock.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, they just dismissed the whole school.
So was everybody in the family pretty upset?
Yeah. Well, that's one of the kind of things. Reason I called is that sort of all the emotions were spent. You know, people were crying,
mm-hmm.
And of course, there was a lot of loss of hope, and many felt. And this is not talked about anymore, that many felt that Kennedy was killed because of his relationship in the black community.
Yeah.
We have all the Cuba thing and all that, but many in the black community felt because Kennedy was for progress and his relationship with King and others was the reason that he was assassinated.
Right. Well, thanks for your call, Romy.
Thanks a lot for that, Romy.
Romy, I really appreciate talking to you.
No problem. And good luck to you guys.
Okay, right, thanks. Take it easy. So listen to this. Tom DeLay's former spokesperson. Yeah, before I just launch into news, I mean, those kind of memories, you know, when somebody's pulling something out of their heart and you can just hear it in their voice that they're putting it together in their head and they're reflecting on something as tragic and as shocking as that that day was. It resonates with me. I'm very appreciative of these calls to share the emotions with this because, like I said, I don't have a point of reference for it, but I do remember what it felt like on 9/11 to have reality just pulled out from under you. You know, I remember the day Reagan was shot, but that, you know, initially I was like, really? That's great. And then he lived. So I that's wrong. Isn't that wrong? That's so wrong, but not really.
It's par for the course for this show.
Oh.
Dead Reagan Monday?
Yeah, Dead Reagan Monday. Sure. That was a monumental day. We were the only one that did that. The Dead Reagan Palooza show. The celebration of Reagan's death. It only happened on this show, on this network. I remember that. That was a big turning point for this show, man. It really was. And we'll do that, you know, as we reflect on some of our best moments in the first week or so of December, you know, looking back at the Morning Sedition and what it was. And
yeah, because it's going to be Dead Morning Sedition December.
Yeah, there's going to be an ongoing funeral for this show for as long as Air America lives after this. But things are looking up in terms of some other possibilities here at the network for me. All right, so, and it is all about me, isn't it? What were we going to do? Tom DeLay's former spokesperson and Jack Abramoff's business partner, Michael Scanlon, was charged with one count of conspiracy to defraud Indian tribes of millions of dollars and has started to sing to save his own behind. He appeared yesterday in U.S. District Court to present a plea bargain with the Justice Department that will lead to his cooperation with investigators. Scanlon is facing 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. He has agreed to give back $19 million. He fraudulently charged Indian tribe clients. The plea also contains Scanlon's agreement to testify against Representative Robert Ney of Ohio. Man, what is it with Ohio? What a dirty, filthy bunch of politicians from Ohio. Isn't they got that...
I mean, Ken Blackwell, Gene Schmidt, who was it?
Taft?
Yeah, Taft, Traficant. I mean,
who was the guy? The stamp guy, the guy who sold the stamp collection for millions of dollars and took the money.
Was that?
He got busted too. Yeah. Brendan's going to find out for it. But Ohio is like the worst. But look at this. Scanlon admitted that he and Abramoff offered bribes on behalf of clients for a 4-year period that began in like 2000. The date's unclear. It started in 2000, but it's listed as 2001, so it would have been started in 2001. But the bribes for this guy Ney, for Representative Robert Ney of Ohio, Republican. This is for providing legislation, agreeing to put statements in the congressional record, contacting federal officials to influence decisions, meeting with Abramoff and Scanlon's clients and endorsing. This, he got a wireless communications contract for a company that was one of Scanlon's people to wire the House office building. And this is one of those guys, not unlike DeLay. Ney, he took a golf trip to Scotland. They put $4,000 to his campaign committee, $10,000 to the National Republican Campaign Committee with credit to Ney, meals and drinks, of course, all he wanted at Abramoff's Signatures restaurants. And in he got this stuff. He did this stuff. He was bribed. He was actually successfully bribed, and he made a decision. I'm sure he'll say he didn't know what was going on, but he said, look, I want to get into business with you guys. What do you need?
Well, look, this is the situation. First of all, we should say that Scanlon, even $19 million out of his pocket, is no big deal. He owns a house in St. Bart's. Now, any of you who know anything about the Caribbean know that St. Bart's is the most expensive place for people to own property in the Western Hemisphere, just about. I mean, that's the place Madonna and Mick Jagger and all those kind of luminaries have. So $19 million apparently is not that much money to this guy if he agreed right off the top to pay it back.
Well, they made like $82 million. They collected between the two of them $82 million.
Yeah, well, you know, and you don't hear Abramoff talking about returning a dime, do you?
No, and he's not talking at all. The guy was no way. He was working with Taft and with Robert Taft, and it was a coin collection scandal. The details are escaping me, but Ohio is dirty and filthy. So this guy, Robert Ney, made congressional record statements in support of Abramoff's purchase of Sun Cruise casino boats, which is what he's been indicted for. In terms of fraud and conspiracy, and
where the guy ended up dead.
The guy who owns Sun Cruise ended up dead. This guy Abramoff. The reason we're talking about this, and the reason I'm obsessed with it, and it's very difficult to get all the information out every time we talk about it, because it's one of those very broad conspiracies. Is that now that Robert Nye is going down, or Ney? All right, that means that DeLay could go down. You know, Hastert could go down. There's a lot of people that are connected to Abramoff one way or the other, through the Mariana Islands, through the Indian tribes, through being sort of pushed or coerced or bribed to write the Department of Interior in defense or in support of his Indian tribe clients. Many congressmen and some senators could really take the hit on this one. So it's very exciting, because once there's a snitch and then someone is implicated in a real way, then it just becomes a domino effect.
Why does Interior Secretary Gail Norton have a job in the wake of all of this nonsense?
Yes. Well, that's true, and I think that crap's going to hit the fan, along with the more stuff that's going to be revealed in the leak case when Fitzgerald's investigation is coming out. And now, as we move towards a real sort of bipartisan, not even bipartisan, there's a cultural momentum to at least have a plan to withdraw the troops from Iraq, and that is splitting the Republicans as well. And the Democrats are all of a sudden coming together on something that looks like a national security platform that they could hijack from the Republicans, which would be amazing. And we're going to talk about that in just a minute. It's 48 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Is it possible for you to shut the f*** up for 10 seconds?
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
It's 52 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
The devil, Peter, in New Jersey, who sent me the letter basically just describing a meat fiesta to me and offering to buy me a steak dinner, sent me an email. Mark, send me the bill for your steak dinner, and in parentheses it says, for one, including one drink and a baked potato. All right, so he's going to do it. So this is the devil talking to me. On the other side, I got some vegetarians writing me, sympathizing for the plight. Man.
Keep up the fight.
I tell you, I got some. That took one slip. You know, that's the problem, man. All it takes is one. Look, folks, it's the 42nd anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. We're taking some calls with people's recollections, reflections from those times, because I was not old enough to remember, and I do find it very effective for me to connect to the event itself with people who do remember it. We have a call from Florida. Juanita, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice
good
to
morning.
Hear you.
Good
How are
morning.
You?
I'm sad.
Yeah.
I'm in M-O-U-R. N-I-N-G sedition.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, it's nice to talk to you.
I was watching As the World Turns, and it came on. My son was born in August of that year, so he was a little tiny baby.
Yeah.
And I was separated, and my dad was outside, and he loved John especially because he had the same birthday.
Sure.
And anyway, then we sat and cried, and it was like a loss of, it's just, you just can't describe it. And down here, we had what they call Southern Democrats, and they didn't even want to be in the room with John Kennedy.
Yeah.
And I agree with the gentleman before that about the black, and certainly down here, he became really hated. First it was the Catholicism, and then it was the, you know...
his relationship with the black community.
Right.
Yeah.
And anyway, he had all these wonderful ideas, but it was an essence. It was something, you know.
Yeah.
It was a hope. Like right now we're in an oppressed state.
Yeah.
We're so oppressed.
Yeah.
And anyway, that's my simple and the first thought I had was Johnson had it.
Yeah, was who?
Isn't that terrible?
Was your first thought you had was what?
That Johnson had it.
That Johnson had it.
That was my first thought.
That he had done it.
Yeah, that he'd had it done.
Oh, you know, you're not the only one, Juanita, who said that over time. But it's interesting, your son is only a month younger than Mark Maron.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Juanita, it was certainly great to talk to you. I hope you're able to have a good day, and thanks for listening to us.
And I just really love y'all. Y'all have just really saved a lot of people's lives.
Oh, thank you.
Including mine.
Oh, thank you so much.
Juanita.
Take care of yourself.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Well, that was sweet.
She sounded like she was getting emotional over the phone there.
Well, I think that had a lot of impact on a lot of people, and just recalling it. I know. Like I said, my mom, this John F. Kennedy made a tremendous and deep connection with this country, certainly with people who wanted a change, who wanted to be released from that oppression. And it's like, what's interesting to me about these calls, Riley, is that there was still that bitter divide, that contempt, that hatred for a guy that was reaching across a racial divide, that was reaching across a religious divide, that was trying to open up the minds and hearts of Americans to maybe include some things that they might not have included before. And just like now, there is that hate, that contempt, that separation, that desire to distance and push away that and kill that type of hope.
Well, see, what was going on in 1963, you have to realize, this is late 63. There was a presidential election the following year. And what a lot of people realized even that early was that the naysayers, the people that hated John Kennedy, were a distinct minority. Everybody figured that when he ran for president next year, that following year in 64, he would win by an absolute landslide, which, by the way, Lyndon Johnson ended up doing.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I just, like, it's now, like, during this time where we're starting to see not so much hope, but at least a little break in the lockdown that this country has been under, certainly since 9/11, certainly since Bush has been president for whatever reason he's president. But some of it's starting to fragment, and it's a scary time because there is no beacon of hope. There's only a certain amount of relief and anticipation that hopefully the GOP, the Republicans, will destroy themselves. But there isn't a beacon of hope, so there's a little fear at the core of them breaking apart. When you see Dick Cheney on TV, you know, starting that...
going off.
Right, but not be contrite, but to back up on his words. When these guys start feeling backed into a corner, I start getting scared. But I'm also excited. But if there was a beacon of hope, that would be helpful. And we're going to try and provide it here over the top of the hour with some information about the Democrats. More calls from you. It's 57 past Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition. On Air America Radio.
Blah, 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 blah. It's 6 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yep.
The show is Morning Sedition. The network is Air America Radio. If you're in New York, it's New York's Progressive Talk. If you're in Los Angeles, it's K-Talk. How are you? Good morning. If you're anywhere in between those coasts, I don't know what it's called, but I'm glad you're listening. Look, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, and you lurking conservatives, today is the 42nd anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. We've been taking calls all morning of people giving me and Riley their recollections of that day. I was 2 months old. I have none. But I do remember the impact that 9/11 had on me that morning of having everything just shift. The entire reality just turned and got screwy. And everything was sad and dark and incredibly frightening. And I know that a lot of people had those type of experiences in seeing John F. Kennedy assassinated on television. It was a much more intimate media environment. It resonated throughout the world like nothing else seems to be able to possibly do other than incredible catastrophes. And that seems to be a theme that is that has resonated throughout the history of television. But I would like you to continue to call 866-303-2270 and share those moments with me. I got an interesting email here from a guy who was talking about. He says, on the day that Hinckley shot Reagan, I had mentioned that I remember that one, and I was not that upset, quite the opposite. On the day that Hinckley shot Reagan, I was in North Dakota. I heard the news on the radio and returned to my office and told my office partner that someone had shot Reagan. My office partner looked up from writing a manuscript and asked simply, "Is he dead?" I said, "No." And my office partner said, "Pray for infection," and then went back to writing his manuscript. You know, for one of the most liked people in history, certainly many people hated that man, Reagan, and not as many people certainly hated Kennedy, but there were some, as we've talked to some people from the South and some people who were in Dallas has shared with us. But let's get into a little news. We'll load up those calls in just a second. I'll take a call from, it looks like, Staten Island. So hang on there, and we'll get into that. According to the British paper, the Daily Mirror, Bush and company plan to bomb Al Jazeera. That is coming from a Downing Street memo that a conversation between George Bush and Tony Blair about launching a military strike on the station. Well, you know, Blair pointed out to Bush, apparently, that, look, Qatar, where Al Jazeera is headquartered, is an ally. That's the capital. It's busy. There's businesses there. And again, it's an ally. Apparently, there was no comment on the story from Blair. Another British newspaper, The Mirror, said it would have been the most spectacular foreign policy disaster since the war itself. Now, you know, Riley, you were sort of shedding some light on some of the nuances of that story, and that the person that leaked that story apparently, what, has now been arrested?
Has been charged, yeah, okay, under the Official Secrets Act in Britain. But the other side of this is, Mark, that there have been a couple of incidents where Al Jazeera offices were in fact bombed. There was one in Baghdad that was hit by two so-called smart bombs, and an Al Jazeera journalist was killed as well. And now people are starting to say, wait a minute, you know, if Bush really did want to bomb Al Jazeera, and of course his people are saying, well, he was just trying to be humorous. I don't know what kind of joke that is.
No, he was absolutely trying to be real. Whether he's making a joke or not is not the issue. And I think that those attacks that you're talking about, even the shooting of a journalist, that's intentional stuff. The propaganda outlets are always a target when anybody invades anywhere.
Yeah.
This one was just a little more complicated in the world of global media. You know, you're not talking about a local situation.
No, you're not. And actually, it was the Kabul office that was bombed. A journalist was killed in a missile strike on the Baghdad offices of Al Jazeera.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Given the failure of the SUV line that General Motors tried to push last year, which tanked because of the cost of it would take to fill up your tank, as opposed to retool the business and redesign some cars and get the company back on its feet in a way that would help the people that work there, General Motors is going to lay off 30,000 people, which is close to 9% of the North American workforce of 325,000 people. They're closing an engine facility in Flint, a powertrain facility in Ontario, and metal centers in Lansing and Pittsburgh. We'll close three service and parts operations facilities. We'll be closing in Michigan and Oregon. They're trying to cut $7 billion in costs. You know, where is the punishment of the management that made these decisions to stick with this line? How come none of the corporate level executives are taking the hit? Why does it have to be 30,000 plant employees are going to be forced into retirement or cut in some sort of attrition, some sort of tiered cutting of the jobs? And I got to be honest with you, Riley, you know, I'm a little guilty. You and I had a conversation about cars last week. I got to buy a car when I go back to L.A. You can't be in L.A. without a car.
And I know I made the mistake of recommending a non-American built car.
But you're not the only one, my friend. I mean, look, you know, I've been looking at Toyotas. I've driven Toyotas and Hondas all my adult life, really. Mm. I owned a Chevy for a brief time, and it was a piece of garbage. but, you know, I'm willing. I'm open. I'm taking calls or emails at sedition@airamericaradio.com for recommendations of American cars that will give me the same performance and fuel efficiency as a Toyota.
Well, wait a minute. What kind of fuel efficiency? What's your bottom line?
Good. I'm not a flashy guy. I've never owned a new car in my life. I like smaller cars that are not ostentatious and get good gas mileage. I was driving a four-cylinder Honda Accord, a 93 Accord, for a while. I got a 95 Camry back there in L.A. that I bought used that doesn't get good gas mileage. I got to be honest with you. It's a six-cylinder. It's a gas guzzler.
Oh, if it's a six-cylinder, yeah. A four-cylinder Camry, on the other hand, will get you decent gas mileage.
In modern terms, that's a gas guzzler for me, you know. But I am open-minded, and I don't want to piss off American Union, the auto workers union, that's for sure, because I wanted to buy American. I remember when the Ford Escort first came out. Mm-hmm. I was looking at those because I knew they were very popular in Europe, and there was an American model, and I looked at them, and I didn't get one. Is it called the Escort? It's the Ford.
The Ford Escort.
Yeah. But I ended up not buying a car anyways. Or did I buy a used one? No, I didn't buy a car at that time. You don't need one in New York, but I am going back to L.A. So shoot me your recommendation. Now let's get into a little bit of this. Let me take that call from Jack in Staten Island. Jack, you got some personal reflection on the Kennedy assassination for us this morning?
Hey, Jack.
Hi. I do. I was in fourth grade,
yeah.
And the principal came in and told the teacher the president was shot, and here I am only 9 years old, and I'm thinking there's something wrong with my hearing.
Yeah, it was too shocking.
Fast forward.
Yeah.
But in 68 or 69, I read the Life magazine article about Wayne Garrison,
right.
Who was the subject of the JFK movie.
Yep.
And I remember thinking, this thing makes a sense. I mean, this guy is not. They tried to make him look like an eccentric or a nut, and it made sense. So in 1972, when I started college, and one of my professors said there was a conspiracy to kill Kennedy, the Warren Commission was wrong,
mm-hmm.
I knew it was true. And Mark Riley will back me up on this. All the stories you hear over the years, you couldn't help but come to that conclusion.
Yeah.
Yeah, where do you stand on that, Riley? Do you have do you believe it was a lone gunman? Do you still have doubts about that?
Well, I'll tell you, the circumstances at the time were enough to give you doubts.
Sure.
Again, Lee Harvey Oswald, here's this guy, he's from New Orleans, he goes to the Soviet Union, wanted to become a Russian citizen, married a Russian woman, comes back to the States. It just seemed very strange. And no one, as far as I can tell yet, has been able to make people understand how Jack Ruby was afforded such easy access to Lee Harvey Oswald as he was walking through this basement.
Sure.
You know, I mean, it's not like they invited the public to. This wasn't a public perp walk.
Mm-hmm.
He's walking across this. It looked like that scene in Godfather 2 Hyman Roth was coming back, and the guy looks like he's a reporter, pulls out a gun and shoots the guy.
The framing on that, the mise-en-scene of that sequence in The Godfather was definitely taken from
Jack Ruby, from the Oswald
show. Hey, thanks for your call, Jack.
Thank you.
You take care.
Well, the best morning show there is.
Oh, thank you. That's very nice, Jack. Well, you know, it's interesting to me because I had a couple friends, a buddy of mine, a comic, was completely obsessed with the Kennedy assassination. That was the late, great Bill Hicks. I remember sitting in a diner with that guy in San Francisco. We weren't close friends, but he was working in town. I lived there, and I went to say hi. I'd hung out with him a couple times here in New York, and he had books. He would sit in these diners at night, and he would just go, it's got to be. There had to be more people involved. He's looking at pictures. He was frothing about this, and a lot of his greatest jokes revolve around the Kennedy assassination, but it is one of those things that has gotten progressive thinkers and people and seekers of truth, independent investigative speculators, are continuing to create theories. And there is a couple theories that hold. You know, a great book, Libra, by Don DeLillo, was sort of a fictional account of what became the movie that Oliver Stone made, the several angles. And moving towards the moment of assassination in the book Libra is fascinating because you get it from three different perspectives, from three different shooters. So it's 16 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Edition. We are going to talk about what is going on in response to the pullout of the troops in Iraq and how it's galvanizing the Democrats and fragmenting the Republicans, but it seems like the momentum is towards getting the troops out of there. 16 past Air America Radio's Morning Edition.
You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Now, we're not homosexual, but we are willing to learn.
Air America Radio.
Past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. We're taking calls all morning on reflections about the Kennedy assassination. I'll take one in just a second. We're also going to talk about the debate in the House, the debate between Republicans and Democrats, between Republicans and Republicans revolving around the withdrawal for the Iraq war, the framing of the war in this country is shifting. The public and the momentum in the culture is beginning to support a withdrawal. And it's very interesting what's happening politically. I'll talk about that in a second. For those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. GM announced it will close 9 plants in North America by 2008, eliminating 30,000 jobs. GM Chairman and Chief Executive Rick Wagner said, quote, "I prefer to look on the bright side. With less vehicles being produced and less people working and taking the bus because they can't afford car payments or gas, we're going to make a significant contribution to improving air quality and saving the environment. So get off of my ass," end quote. Evangelical pastor Jerry Falwell has announced what he calls a friend or foe Christmas campaign, which will sue or boycott any organization which he feels is trying to put a damper on Christmas celebrations. Falwell's group promises to file suit against anyone who spreads what he sees as misinformation that Christmas can't be celebrated in schools and public spaces, and that particularly applies to restrictions against burning the traditional Yule cross on agitators' lawns. The Christmas Project slogan is, quote, "Merry Christmas. It's okay to say it, and we're pretty flexible on faggot and kike, too," end quote. A South Dakota team... A South Dakota team may have to register as a sex offender after being arrested for trying to have sex with a mannequin. If convicted, the youth may have to register as a sex offender. In that case, every time he moved to a new neighborhood, he would have to inform all the department stores in the area. When the cops charged him with statutory rape, he said, "If I had known it was a statue, I never would have done it." All right, that's all I got on that one. What do you want from me? He humped a mannequin. What do you want? All right, statutory rape. What do you? It's in the words. All right. Good. All right, we're going to take a call. You want to take a call or do? Let's do the story and then take a call.
Yeah.
How would that be? The bottom line, Riley, is that any accusation that the Democrats in the Senate or the House are being hypocritical in their dissent against the war is total spin, okay? They stood, some reluctantly, behind the president that gave them the information that he thought was a valid reason to go to war. Now, that information is coming under scrutiny, and the basic fact that there were no weapons of mass destruction has led the public to realize that, at the very least, that information was BS. The rest might have been criminal BS, given the leak situation and what's coming out. So the Democrats were misled with the rest of the country into, again, some of the people very reluctantly being led into war. They were all misled by this president into believing this war was necessary. So now the Republicans are freaking out because the public has turned against the very platform that they base their existence on. National security. They have been forced by the public's turning on the war to figure out a way to end the war. Now, of course, there are hardliners that are always going to be with what the president says. He never backed down and that kind of stuff. But what's amazing is if the GOP, if the Republicans fragment on the national security platform, the Democrats stand to gain some public trust around this issue by focusing on a reasonable withdrawal plan and putting more attention into effective national security and emergency response. Am I right?
Yeah, and what you're also seeing happen here is a wholesale shift among independent voters.
Mm-hmm.
Voters who largely went with Bush even in 04, but now have seen that this whole thing about why the United States got into the war with Iraq in the first place has been a sham. And now they're starting to track more with the Democrats in this polling than with the Republicans, which they were doing just less than a year ago. Dick Cheney gets up and says that, you know, yesterday he says the critics are corrupt and shameless without ever asking who was corrupt in the first place in talking up the reasons for going to war. It was Dick Cheney, in case anybody forgot.
And he also, he said some interesting stuff. I want to parse that, in a sort of sentence by sentence manner, because he says that the president would never, manipulate or lie, but that doesn't mean the vice president wouldn't. There's some interesting language that we can get into in a second, but this is interesting. Representative Murtha's proposal, along with the cultural momentum, has just led, almost everybody, politicians and people, just regular people, to rethink the ideas about the war, because Murtha said that the Iraqis will make no progress until the Americans leave. And that's been confirmed by a lot of people. We talked to Bob Baer the other day. We talked to Daniel Benjamin, the writer of the new book about that. These are smart people, and they realize that we are just an irritant. And unless we want to get to the point where we're just overseeing death squads that operate at the behest of the Ministry of the Interior through the police force in Iraq, which would make us look like complete, you know, idiots and complete hypocrites, because that is not a democracy, we should get out and let whatever's going to happen happen.
Well, see, John Murtha is not someone that the Republicans realize this, because they backed off their early criticisms of him, because he's not the kind of guy you criticize for coming up not with a statement saying that America should withdraw, but a plan for America to withdraw. And guess who's also talking about America withdrawing? The Iraqis themselves. They're at a meeting in Cairo, and for the first time, their factions all came together, the Kurds, the Shia, the Sunnis, and said, you know what? America needs to put together a timetable for withdrawal.
So that means the fix is in. Let me tell you something. If Shalabi is the guy that presents this to President Bush that the Iraqis want us out, you ought to question the integrity of where that started, because I'm sure that Bush is looking for allies in Iraq to support a withdrawal so he doesn't have to say that he wants to do it, because he doesn't say that.
He's going to declare victory and get out, and the Iraqis are going to give him the lifeline to do it if we're not careful.
Well, in a minute, we're going to have Martin Smith out here. He's a frontline correspondent, and he's got a one of the first and only interviews with Michael Brown since he was demoted. That's a frontline that is going to be on tomorrow night, The Storm, it's called. It's about Katrina. And also, we'll take a couple of your calls about John F. Kennedy after this. 27 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. Good morning. I hope you're having a decent morning getting out of bed. It is sort of a sad day. It is the 42nd anniversary of the Kennedy assassination today. We've been having people call in with their recollections of that day. I was not alive. Well, I was, but I was 2 months old, and so my memory is very, very faint, non-existent. You can't be 2 months old and process something like that, but I was hoping people could share stories with me so I could be brought back in time and understand the significant grief that people felt on that day, and it's been pretty effective. I really appreciate you all calling. We got a call from Columbus, Ohio here. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
How are you doing? Jenny.
Hey, Jeannie. Is your name Jeannie?
Jenny.
Jenny, thanks for calling. What do you have? Do you have a memory you'd like to share with us?
Well, I was telling the fellow that answered the phone, I was a cashier at one of the local chains here that's no longer in business since Bush got in, and we were in the shopping center, as our store was, and a woman came running in. She had just heard on the radio, I'm assuming, because, of course, we had no TVs in the store, and told us that in everybody. We all cried except this one lady that was in line. That this place was a separation between, there was normal people that lived kind of on one side of High Street, and below the other side, there was kind of the real wealthy people that lived back in not a gated community, but a big community in the back. She owned a factory in Columbus and one in Spain, and she was in line, and she was saying, well, good riddance, and she started laughing. She just detested him.
Wow. It's amazing how kind of separated the country was on that guy.
Oh, it was, but you know what? I know this sounds weird, but I always, always believed, I never believed Johnson was behind it, but I always believed the John Birch Society, which I wonder is the John Birch Society from Texas, now the Swift Boat guys, is that the same group?
And it's not the same group, but they all do seem to be connected, and it's sort of like it's like the 6 degrees of the Kennedy assassination. You know, like that game with Kevin Bacon.
He had no money, this guy, and he was a dishonorable discharged guy. He couldn't get a job even picking up trash.
Yeah.
Where did he get all his guns and his plane tickets and...
Wow.
You know, and that's why I always thought, the John Birch Society was always behind it.
Well, I'll work on that, Jeannie. I can't answer all those questions right now, but I'm sure there are some people that are chomping on the bit out there to answer them.
Jenny's not the first.
Oh, yeah.
There are a lot of people who thought that the John Birch Society might have had something.
Oh, yeah, because he had no money.
Yeah.
But I wanted to tell you guys before I hang up, I love your show.
Oh, thank you.
That woman that called Mirtha a coward.
Yeah, Jeannie
Schmidt. Against Paul Hackett.
Right, yeah, we know.
Oh, I didn't know you knew that.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, we mentioned it yesterday, definitely.
Well, she's going to learn how to behave herself in the house, that's for sure.
She reminds me of Catherine Harris.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're
about
both
half a wacko.
Yeah. They're both evil succubus whack jobs. Yeah. Jeannie, thanks so much for calling.
Okay. Bye, you guys.
Bye, bye.
Take care.
Tonight on PBS's Frontline, former FEMA director Michael Brown gives his first televised interview since his resignation, where you'll hear him say things like this to our next guest.
Well, I'll tell you what we'll do. Next time there's a really big disaster, we'll put you in charge of it. We'll not give you any sleep, and we'll put you on this side of the chair, on this side of the camera, and we'll pepper you with questions for a couple hours at a time and see how tired you are.
Frontline correspondent Martin Smith joins us live in the studio this morning. Good morning, Martin.
Good morning.
Morning.
I can't believe the attitude and tone of that guy after all is said and done that he's still blaming everybody but himself.
Well, you know, he does take the blame for failing to call in troops. He says that near the end of the program, he says my biggest mistake was just not getting the troops in there soon enough, believing that we could do it ourselves.
And that's the only thing that he took responsibility for?
Well, I got to say that compared to the governor of Louisiana,
mm-hmm.
he was more contrite.
Mm-hmm.
She said in an address to her state legislature that the buck stopped with her on failures and missteps, and I asked her what that meant. And she says, well, my failure was depending on Michael Brown.
Okay. Well, I think he deserves some of that. And I think that, like, when I watch some of this interview that you did with Michael Brown, this is going to be on Frontline tonight. I thought he was there was something pathological with him. It wasn't just, you know, talking points. It wasn't towing the party line. But it seemed like he could not admit to himself just the scope of his mistakes.
Well, I felt that during the interview that the gravity of the situation wasn't really coming home to him.
Right. That's exactly what I sense. Because I've seen even now the way that New Orleans is horrendous. I saw footage on a show yesterday, and it's never going to recover. And that's going to be with this guy, I think, till the end of his life. So I mean, he's still got some time to get straight with his creator if he wants to.
He seems very resilient. He's very confident.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I can note is that I couldn't find a frame of footage of him in New Orleans during the crisis.
Incredible. Wasn't there, or at least no footage of him.
I kept screaming at my staff. I said, give me some footage of him there. And he was in Baton Rouge,
mm-hmm.
And he was in Mississippi, but I never saw him other than on the tarmac near Air Force One when they landed at New Orleans Airport.
Yeah, so he could run up and go, what do I do? What do I do? What do I say?
You know,
Martin,
he,
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No, I was curious because we've seen over the last few days a number of reports about the aftermath of Katrina and about exactly what has happened since most of the media have left New Orleans and the story has kind of gone on the back burner. And it's not a pretty sight in terms of, as Mark points out, some of the visual images, but also the fact that very little work has actually been done to make New Orleans whole again.
You know, there are a lot of contractors down there, but I think it's the enormity of the disaster that you can't grasp. I didn't understand it from reading the newspaper accounts or watching television before I went down there. You have to get in a helicopter or get in a car and just go for miles and see the amount of devastation to realize that the number of contractors they have there cannot begin to put a dent in the amount of, you know, what's needed to be done is so immense.
Our guest is Martin Smith, correspondent for PBS's Frontline, which is going to be airing the documentary on Katrina tonight called The Storm. It's at 9 p.m. Eastern on PBS here on the East Coast. Now, Martin, it seems that there's two schools of thought about what should happen with New Orleans now. There's a school of thought that thinks that for geographical reasons and for erosion reasons that it shouldn't be rebuilt. There are people that think for political and financial reasons that it should be rebuilt, but not inviting the same class of people back into the city. What was your sense of where that's going?
Well, the French Quarter is already up and running.
It didn't get hit as bad, right?
It didn't get hit that bad. But I mean, that's become the core of one of the main cores
mm-hmm.
of the economy.
Mm-hmm.
The oil money that is generated in and around New Orleans doesn't really stop in New Orleans. It goes to Houston and beyond. So they depend on tourism. that's operating. And if you're going to have conventions, tourism, you got to have people that are going to make the beds and clean the toilets. And so they're going back.
They're going to go back.
They're going to go back. It's going to take a long time. I don't think anybody knows what it's going to look like. I mean, the mayor was talking about more casinos.
Ugh.
So
I mean, I see how that generates money for the state, but it always, like, there's a certain old school sleaziness to New Orleans. It's kind of romantic and exciting and very compelling. But once you bring the sort of, you know, new school sleaziness of gambling into a city, it kind of it decays something, I think.
Yeah, I talked to people from New Orleans. They say, you know, we were always known for our food and for parties, mm-hmm. and laisser le bon temps rouler, mm-hmm. and the whole business. But I found this sort of discomfort with how it's been marketed across the country as a kind of Vegas of the South.
Yeah.
As a kind of place where you go and you get bombed and you mm-hmm. walk up and down half naked up and down Bourbon Street.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are the bars and the strip clubs. It's more than ever.
Yeah.
So that's become a core of their economy. There is a beautiful New Orleans and a beautiful culture,
yeah.
and wonderful people that hosted us when we were there. Very difficult place to work, by the way. I've worked in Iraq, but logistically I found working...
New Orleans was rougher.
Well, to find a hotel room, to find a meal, to make a phone call, the whole bit was really difficult.
Now, you're talking about a city of about 500,000 people. I saw a report the other day that says there are about 65,000 people who are actually living in New Orleans today. Do you really think that the people who have gone to Houston and Dallas and many of these other cities will not try and put down roots there rather than come back to a very uncertain situation in New Orleans?
Well, they're not going to come back quickly, and a lot of them, I guess, will drift away. A lot of those people, though, had never been outside of New Orleans. I mean, I saw an interesting report where, you know, these people were going off to Houston and finding out that there were textbooks in the schools that were, you know, post-Johnson administration textbooks. And they were going to come back to New Orleans and have a few more demands, or they're going to decide not to go back.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the very high percentage of the people that lived in New Orleans, in Lower Ninth Ward, those kinds of neighborhoods, had never really been outside. So that is their firm roots there, and I suppose those people will want to come back.
Now, in what you've experienced down there and the people you've talked to and some of the interviews you did, I know you talked to Ray Nagin. What does he see for the future of New Orleans?
You know, I was talking to him about the storm, didn't get into talking about the future. I mean, I think that he's just looking for any, opportunity he can
sure.
get in terms of getting the economy back on his feet.
Now, in terms of FEMA, it seems to me that they still haven't got their act together. It seems to me that the Homeland Security Department, it's in and of itself, has not got its act together. Is there any way, did you get any sense that these people were going to take sincere actions, that any changes have been made since Katrina? What's the new guy like?
Well, you know, there's always talk of reform after the fact.
Sure.
You know, you always sort of wear your seatbelt after the accident,
mm-hmm.
and then, you know, you fall back. But the problem is the great irony here is that we create this huge Department of Homeland Security with 180,000 people, and you put FEMA inside it, and suddenly, you know, in a storm, you got to have quick reaction. You got to be quick on your feet. Well, they have to go through several layers of bureaucracy to get a decision made. And so by the creation of this department and folding FEMA into it, they've created a lot of problems for our disaster response.
Well, let's hear another segment from the interview you did with Michael Brown in relation to what we're talking about. This is Martin Smith speaking to former FEMA director Michael Brown.
With all due respect to them, I think they were just truly overwhelmed.
Well, as I understand it, when local officials are overwhelmed, that's why we have FEMA.
That's correct. But FEMA does that based upon the priorities of what the state establishes. The state is still in control. We don't come in and take over. We don't have the resources to take over.
Is that correct? Is he right there?
It's a very murky area of law. And that's really at the core of the problem.
Mm.
Because when you have a shared responsibility between states and cities and the feds, it's very easy for things to fall through the crack.
Mm-hmm.
And in a case where you have the locals overwhelmed and FEMA's looking for direction from the state, it's kind of like asking the guy who comes into the emergency room on the gurney where you want the doctors to operate.
Hmm. Interesting.
Now, you spend quality time in New Orleans. Are you optimistic about its future? And are you optimistic about the future of, I guess, government agencies who are charged with the responsibility of reacting to storms like Katrina? Are you confident that they will get better?
Well, I'm hopeful. On the first question, I don't know about New Orleans. I imagine that it's going to be rebuilt there just because so many people, it's human to rebuild in that city. It's been there for a long time. I don't think people are thinking about a city down the pike somewhere. As far as reforming the agency, we have been rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic for some time now, and it's a very difficult task that we set out when we formed the third largest agency in the government, the biggest government reorganization in the last 40 years, to expect that this thing is going to move quickly and be fast on its feet. Since 9/11, when we knew that communication systems were important to responding to a disaster, you know, having police and firemen able to talk to one another, we still haven't been able to come up with a system that works. We're 4 years down the pike. And when I talked to Secretary Tom Ridge, he was acting like, you know, that was an unreasonable demand that we have something in place.
Well, that's crazy, because just with the technology that is available on a private level, it seems that you can almost pull something together. And that shouldn't be the responsibility of a fire department. It should be the responsibility of the government to put these technologies in place so they can be utilized. It just seems like the technology is out there and the expertise is out there. It's crazy bureaucratic BS that it can't happen.
Well, yeah, it has to do with ideology. It has to do with saying to the federal government has a coordinating role.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have something like New Orleans, and the fire department comes in or the police department comes in from out of state, and their radios don't talk to the local radios. So
right.
You need somebody to sort of arbitrate and coordinate this, and that's the role of the federal government.
Now, do you think that then, first of all, I mean, I have to imagine that the morale of people at FEMA is completely battered right now, and I have to imagine that they're craving some change. Do you think that the head of FEMA should be a cabinet position again?
I think that he said whether it's a cabinet position, he should have cabinet-like ability to communicate directly with the president in a crisis. You can't go through two layers of Homeland Security bureaucracy.
During an emergency.
Yeah. You've got to have access.
Right.
Because all FEMA is a bunch of people with phones. They have some rapid response. They have about 28 rapid response teams. They're about 60 people each. But basically, these are people with telephones that coordinate aid.
Mm-hmm.
They make phone calls. They get the Pentagon involved or whatever it need be.
Okay. Well, now it seems to me then, how are the people, just to address the other issue that I brought up, how are the people at FEMA feeling in relation to or in the shadow of what happened at Katrina? What is the morale at the agency? What did you hear from them?
Well, very, very low.
Mm.
And I've talked to people who have been with FEMA for a long time, and they've gone through highs and lows. This has been an agency that traditionally has been a kind of a parking lot or a turkey farm for political appointees. And it was fixed in the 90s by sort of a widespread consensus across the aisle. Both Democrats, Republicans agreed that FEMA was in good shape.
Yeah.
So we messed up what was we broke what was fixed.
And Michael Brown is one of those great examples of just a political appointee. Someone was doing someone a favor.
Well, you know, Michael Brown, to give him credit, is outspoken in the documentary about how FEMA has been hurt by being taxed by the bureaucracy at Homeland Security. He's been complaining for some time now.
Okay, well, I look forward to watching the entire documentary. I watched the interview with Michael Brown, and I found that very compelling, and I recommend everyone else to watch it as well. That's Frontline's The Storm. It airs tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern. Martin Smith, it was great talking to you. Appreciate you coming down.
Good to be here. Thanks a lot.
All right, so we'll talk to you in a second. It's 50 past. We're coming back with Angus McFarker, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition.
Just to wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Five past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. It's Tuesday morning. Hope you're having a decent morning. Today is the 42nd anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. That doesn't make for good coffee feelings, but nonetheless, it is a day of reflection. We've been taking calls from people who have been reflecting on that day as they remember, because I don't remember, and it's very helpful for me to hear people's experience, to connect with the feelings that the country must have felt on that day. In the three biggest wars since World War II, that's Korea, Nam, and Iraq, public support waned as the more Americans were killed but not as quickly as now in the first two. In terms of Vietnam and Korea, those took a while for the public to sort of wane in their support. And the bottom line is this isn't communism. This is terrorism. And the frame they set, that is the Republicans, Dick Cheney, in relation to Iraq, is not holding. Bush's handling of the war is now at 35% approval rating. Just 7 months into the war, Gallup found that the percentage of Americans who viewed the sending of troops as a mistake jumped substantially from 25% in March 2003 to 40% in October 2003. A lot of people don't realize how quickly it happened, how quickly support for that war started to diminish. As casualties in Korea, Vietnam, and now Iraq wars mounted, the support declined. But in June 2004, for the first time, more than half of the public thought the U.S. had made a mistake with Iraq, and that number remains today. It remains steady. Of course, this has to do with new revelations about the intelligence being manufactured, and of course, about the death toll of American military, climbing over 2,000 people. With Vietnam, the 50% threshold was not crossed until August 1968, and that was several years into the war. And with Korea, it was March 1952, about a year and a half into U.S. involvement. But I'll tell you, the media helps this, Riley, because you see it. You see it every day. They can't hide as much. And when the truth starts to seep out, it seeps out throughout the culture very quickly.
Well, it is seeping out through the culture very quickly, as is the role of both the president, vice president, and the inner members of the cabinet in dragging us into this quagmire in the first place.
And we're going to get into that in the next hour, but we've got the Liberal Confessional and Angus McFarker coming up just over the top. So hang out. It's worth it. It's 57 past. Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition.
I'm David Orrick.
Six past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Morning.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, and of course, you lurking conservatives, your days are numbered. Over the weekend, the second round of parliamentary, come on, man, read the copy, you dummy. Don't you like how you get both sides of the conversation that's going on within me? There are several others. Someday I'll let you in on those. One of them is constantly going, Hey, fatty, why are you so fat? All right. Over the weekend, or as my trainer says, my trainer, who is not really a trainer, he's my Jubu Buddhist yoga guy, who I hang out with twice a week to stay healthy. In my pleading, I just sat there. Kayla, look at me. I sat there looking in the mirror, pinching myself, saying, what do you think? Can you see it? What's going on? He goes, you're a woman. That's what he said to me. You're a woman. And I don't think that's reserved for women. Do you? I think that men do. Am I the only one? I am the only one.
I think
here.
We should get letters for that.
Yeah, okay. Over the weekend, a second round of parliamentary elections has sparked several violent incidents in Egypt. And now, with more on this story, is Morning Sedition foreign correspondent Angus McFarker reporting from Alexandria. Hello, Angus. How are conditions there right now?
Oh, I'm stoked about this one, Mark.
Yeah.
This is shaping up to be a savage, unrelenting Middle Eastern brawl.
Uh-huh.
Promoters are already calling it the dust-up in the dinner.
Come on.
A very nasty physical game here.
Oh, yeah.
In Alexandria, 42 people have already been injured.
Well,
brilliant.
Are you okay there, Angus?
Oh, never better.
Uh-huh.
Both my kidneys are purple. I bit off part of my tongue, and my pee is the color of cranberry juice. Oh, it's good to be alive. I'm in agony.
I hate to ask you for some news, but who are the opposing groups?
Okay, on one side, you've got the ruling National Democratic Party, the NDP, who are on their home turf.
Mm-hmm.
Authoritarian, short-tempered, classic autocrats. These lads put down rebellion with a ruthless brutality reminiscent of the KGB or the Gestapo.
Uh-huh.
A class act all the way, Mark.
Yeah.
When they bust ahead, it stands busted.
Okay, and then who's the other side on this?
Well, it's the up-and-coming Muslim Brotherhood, an outlaw gang of vicious lads who have doubled their seats in Parliament, and that's got the NDP filling their trousers with butt biscuits, I must say.
Oh, no.
They're pussy worried.
Well, they've been around for a while, but how would you describe the Muslim Brotherhood there, Angus?
Oh, wild-eyed fundamentalists. Fearless. motivated, never up for civil disobedience. No, they go right for the jugular every time. Plus, they know the importance of burning things, Mark. There's a real sense of animosity in the air. And all in all, I'd say the stage is set for maximum violence. So
what's happening? What's happening right now, Angus?
Well, it's still a bit early.
Yeah.
They're feeling each other out.
Uh-huh.
Oi, what's this? A few of the Brotherhood have broken into a polling station, and they've got the ballot box nicely played. Come on, lads. Are you going to burn that ballot box, or are you going to stick your todger in it?
Angus, we talked about this. Don't encourage demonstrators to burn things.
Oh. And the Brotherhood have got out the torches, and it's gone!
Oh, no. Oh, no. No.
Burn, you bastard! Burn the
bastard!
No,
stop it, Angus. Come on, Angus. You got to stop doing that, Angus. Angus.
Right on schedule.
Oh,
the
NDP
is coming in with the riot gear.
Oh,
oh, we've got a lovely fight in that
end. Oh, no.
Time for me to get in the game. Oh, look, Aziz. I'm wiping my crusty backside with the garage.
Oh, no.
Oh,
no.
Oh,
boy. Hey, hey.
Oh,
boy. Oh, no. All right. All right. Angus. 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 Angus.
Oh,
no. Oh, no, no. Not again. Angus. Angus. Hello?
Oh, God.
That's it?
Did I hear him call somebody an Egyptian wanker?
I think he said right in the pyramid.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if he's the right guy to do that job. Hey, I just wanted to bring this up. It's been sitting in front of me all day. But Link Wray, one of the great guitarists, is dead at 76 years old. He died in his home in Copenhagen.
I'm shocked. I never thought Link Wray was that old. I thought he was at least, I thought he was early 60s, mid-60s.
Well, I guess this is just a statement because he seems to have died November 5th. This guy had a great guitar sound. He wrote the song Rumble. He wrote Rawhide. But if you know the sound, apparently he got the sound. I think I read an interview with John Lennon. I'm not sure who, but John Lennon loved him. And you can hear it in later Lennon, some of the Lennon early, the first couple Lennon solo albums, that Link Wray used to literally just have an amp. And I think the first time he got the sound, that fuzzy, ultra-distorted sound, he actually broke the speaker. There it is. It's just, you could just hear the sound of the guitar just, fragmenting.
Yeah.
But that was what he's known for. And he would get into those riffs and just push them.
Well, he's one of those guys. He's like Charlie Parker. You can hear that guitar in so many people that came after him.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
I mean,
just
an incredible number.
He invented distortion on some level. He took the electric guitar to the next step, and he stuck with that sound all the way. It's the Link Wray sound. That was it. See you later, Link. Thanks for the rock and roll.
Yeah.
Hey. Oh, yeah. Those are the kind of licks I grew up on, because my dad was such a, so into the early rock and roll. But I actually bought a Link Wray collection, and I think right when I started working here, we dumped some of those into some of the intros and outros music. I think we've used them for a while. Gotta love the Link Wray. So according to a British paper, should we do that? Yeah, do that, the British paper? Yeah.
I love this paralysis that happens every time to time. So, of course, what just happened?
Well, let's do the confessional. Let's
sure. You know what? Let's just get rid of all this stuff.
Yeah, right.
I pushed Brendan over the edge. All right, well, just for that, look, according to a British paper, the Daily Mirror, Bush and company planned to bomb Al Jazeera. And apparently Tony Blair said, we can't bomb Al Jazeera, Georgie, because it's in Qatar, which is an ally, and it's right in the middle of the capital city of Doha, and if we do that, it'd be a disaster, and there'd be reprisals, and it'd just be stupid. This is from a Downing Street memo that was leaked by a guy who got busted for leaking it, which means it must be true. So, but it is not an unusual tactic to bomb the propaganda outlet, but they could bomb Fox News. Unfortunately, that's where I would actually appreciate a terrorist act, is if they blew up Fox News.
Oh,
is that mean? Is that wrong of me? No, it's not. Absolutely. Hey, Mark, that's going to be a confession for next week. But it's not always easy being a weirdo. We all stray from the straight and narrow from time to time. But when we need to unburden ourselves, we can always confess our liberal sins. If you want to take a turn in the liberal confessional, give us a call at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. But right now it's my turn. Bless me, Brother Riley, for I have sinned.
How can I ease your burden, my son?
All right. So some of you already know this, but I'm up in Burlington, Vermont. I'm at this restaurant called Libby's Diner. It's great food. It's awesome.
All right.
Uh-huh. So I order a biscuit with gravy.
Uh-oh. Would that be a biscuit with...
Yes, sausage gravy. Oh, yeah. Big chunks of pork from a pig who never did anything to me.
So Mark Maron, vegetarian, liberal spokesman, went into a public restaurant, ordered sausage gravy, and ate it?
I ate that gravy like a lion eating a zebra, Riley. It was awesome. I mean, my taste buds just exploded, Brother Riley. They haven't been this happy in a long, long time. Oh, my God, I'm starting to sweat just thinking about it.
That's the problem with things that are bad for us. They seem fantastic at the time.
All right, so what do I do now? I broke my rule. I ate meat, and now I'm like, what the hell? Genie's out of the bottle. The meat light just turned green. Let's go.
You don't really mean that.
Oh, yes, I do, Riley. That gravy was like a gateway drug, and now I'm like, hey, Thanksgiving's coming up on Thursday. I'm cooking. It's turkey time. The whole world of meat is once again available to me. Hot dogs and chops and steaks and venison and burgers and giblets and the tartar and barbecue and everything. I'm on a slippery slope, Riley. I've got a full-on meat Jones going here, and I'm going to have to eat something dead real soon, Riley.
But you won't, Mark, and you know why?
No. You got any jerky?
Because, despite this one relapse, there is a much larger part of you that has decided not to eat meat. And that part of you is stronger than the Mark Maron that ate that sausage gravy this past weekend, pal.
Oh, God, it was delicious, man.
I don't really have to tell you your penance, do I?
No more meat?
No more meat.
Okay, no more meat. But what about if I
No!
Just... How about some bacon? You know, just maybe a slice now and then.
No!
So what you're saying is that I have to stop eating meat now?
Penance is a harsh mistress, Mark. Have a carrot. Now go forth and sin no more.
Amen. Thank you, Brother Riley.
I will not fear my meat.
Oh, I do. I do. I fear the meat. I fear it. But I want it. Now, if anyone else out there wants to confess and seek absolution, our liberal confessional, you can give us a call right now at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. The confession booth is open at 16 past the hour. Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Call us at 866.
Ha! That's awesome. Go on.
303.
Wow. Yes. Yes. I love it.
2270.
Oh, yeah. Drop the bomb. Drop it. There's not a dry eye in the house. Keep going.
That's 866-303-2270.
Okay. Well, just so you know, it was good, but I was also being pretty generous.
This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Twenty past the hour, it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
That's Link Ray that you hear behind us. Link Ray is dead at 76. Apparently died on November 5th. The announcement came out this morning. Died at his home in Copenhagen. One of the great rock and roll guitar players. The confession booth is open at 866-303-2270. We're taking your liberal confessionals. Rob in New York, how have you sinned? Rob, what is your sin?
Good morning, Mark and Mark. How are you?
All right, okay. Rob.
How can we help you?
I'll tell you, I feel really upset about this. I'm actually Rob DePore. I'm a billionaire for Bush. I'm using that name because I don't want to use my real name.
Okay.
This is the actual truth.
Mm-hmm.
I bought some Starbucks stock.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Starbucks, I thought, was a good company, and they give a lot of money to progressive causes, especially during the last presidential campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, I made some money off of it, but I feel really guilty now because I realize, of course, that they're really prone to union busting. And every time they try to, you know, people try to unionize and for, you know, better benefits,
mm-hmm.
and health care and stuff like that, these people wind up getting fired.
Wow.
So now I've made some money off of this, and yet, you know, I think I'm hurting my own cause. And
well, I think that your penance is clear. I think that you have to go get a part-time job at Starbucks and try to unionize and see how that feels. See how it feels to be isolated and fired for political action.
I think you may have a point there, because I think these people really want to do good things. And of course, I want to do good things. And, you know, making this extra money, maybe I should just go down there, like, actually hand money to people. I mean,
I think you need to get a job and either feel what it feels like to feel the wrath of Starbucks union busting attitudes, or become the Norma Rae of Starbucks.
Oh, I like that.
And then you can wear a new costume.
Oh, I like that.
Oh,
beautiful. Thank you, guys.
Okay, take care.
Right,
go forth and sin no more. All right, Julie in Oregon, what is your sin?
You know, I hate to admit this. I feel it's incredibly vain, but I went to a tanning bed yesterday.
Whoa!
And I go every couple months just because, I just end up feeling so pasty. But I'm in Oregon.
Who are you fooling in Oregon? You're like one of the weird orange people. You think anyone's looking at you going, wow, did she go on vacation? I haven't seen her leave. I work with her. Oh, she's one of the weird orange people that cooks herself.
Yeah, I feel it's incredibly vain. What should my penance be? I just don't know what to do.
Oh, my God. What should your penance be? For being incredibly vain and tanning at a tanning salon. Oh, my God. It's a tough one. I think that maybe you could always go, take a couple of, why don't you take a couple of homeless people to Florida? and get some real sun and buy them and food and put them up in a hotel room and that way you do a little public service and also you get a real tan. You don't have to lie to people anymore.
Would donating to the Hurricane Katrina fund would that suffice?
Yeah, that would suffice, but still maybe you have to. Do you wear makeup at all?
Rarely.
You just wear the weird orange tan that you get.
No. I just go into the tan once every other month or so. I work from home. I do contract and consulted work. So occasionally I feel like I have to come out of my hole.
Yeah, maybe you ought to send money to cancer research.
Hey!
Specifically, that melanoma of the skin that comes from weird light bulbs that people tan with.
Excellent.
All right, so I figured it out. No, there's other options, too. You can go get a real tan, maybe going somewhere and doing some public service. Why don't you fly down to New Orleans and see if you can help anyway and get some sun that way?
That's a good idea. There's a lot of pets down there that are needing some help.
Do you need a cat?
Pardon?
Do you need a cat?
I got a parrot, so that won't work.
Oh, man.
Would you get your cat
Thank
from
you for
Oregon.
Your call. I hope we helped in some way.
Yeah,
okay, thank you very much. No, I can't give away my cat. Every time I say I'm going to give away one of the cat to a good home, I got this woman, Fran, or is it Fran? I can't remember her name, but it's one of the cat women that that I got in contact with initially when I saved the cat's lives and now would like to find one of them a good home. But she's like, you can't give them away. They're your children. You're their mother. You can't give them away. You have to take them with you. I'm like, I'm going to have five cats. She's like, I don't care. I have nine or six. Anyways.
It's called responsibility.
All right. I think we have a unique twist on the liberal confessional. I think I'm getting an absolution. Linda in Florida, what is your sin or what is your absolution for me if you can be a liberal purveyor of absolution?
Yes, I understand you're having guilt over eating meat and you're wondering how to deal with Thanksgiving. And I must tell you that I, too, like I don't eat veal, anything like you say with eye or the collar.
Yeah.
Yes, you had before eyes and the parent. You don't want to do that.
Right.
However, I have been chased by a turkey. I used to have a couple of quarter horses, and in the barn, the turkey came after me, and I was told unless I went after the turkey, unless I went after the turkey, he would come after me aggressively, and he
right.
did.
Right.
I took a few steps faster, he took a few steps faster, and I had to go after him with a pitchfork by pretend, but to get him off of the aggressive chase. So now I eat turkey without regret. And I think you should do the same.
Do you live in the 1800s?
No. I used to have some show horses.
Oh,
and
okay.
This happens. It came into the barn where I kept boarded my horses.
So you're saying that the turkeys are mean and they chased you and they deserve to be eaten.
And they're heartless. And they're heartless. They're worse than fish.
Did you eat that turkey?
They're worse
Linda?
Than fish.
Yes.
You ate the turkey that chased you?
Well, no, I didn't eat it. I didn't catch it, but I never knew that about turkeys until I encountered one.
Well, you have changed my entire attitude about turkeys, and I'm not going to hang out with them anymore.
No, they're prolific, and you're not hurting anybody by eating a turkey for Thanksgiving.
Well, thank you for absolving me of that guilt.
Okay, enjoy.
I appreciate
Bye-bye.
It.
Yeah, I fully intended to eat turkey no matter what their disposition.
You know, some people who have farms and they have relationships with the animals they kill, I think there's something... kind of a respectable about that. It's always interested me that they understand the relationship and there's an intimacy to it and they know where it came from and where it's going.
I will not fear my meat.
I'm rationalizing, aren't I? Well, I've got some other stuff here. We're going to talk to David Poland in a minute about movies, 27 Past.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
8:34 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. This has been a fun show. I wonder if that has to do with me leaving today for the Thanksgiving vacay. That's what I say there, Riley. You're going to be here by yourself tomorrow because I'm going down to see my mommy in Florida.
What?
Yeah.
What, you mean you're not even going to call in during the Mark Maron segment tomorrow?
Maybe I will. I don't know.
You're going to miss Mark Green.
I know I'm going to miss Mark Green.
Wow.
I know. I don't. You know what? Maybe I'll stay. Because I didn't thought about it that way, that I'm going to miss Mark Green. I should stay tomorrow.
Definitely.
Yeah, but I'll have my, you know, I'll call in during Mark's segment.
You know, I'll tape it for you.
Oh, I'm going to give this guy, you know, this guy is sending, like, you know, three emails, and he just wants attention so badly. He's out there in Geneva, Switzerland, apparently alone at his computer, and he writes, this is the third one I've gotten. Mark, you're supposed to beat the meat, not eat the meat.
I will not fear my meat.
I don't fear it. I will not fear it anymore. Well, that's what a lot of people are writing now. They're helping me rationalize. A lot of progressives are saying if it's really just an issue of dirtiness, then I should get better meat. Right now, it's time to get the real story out of Hollywood as opposed to what they tell you on Entertainment Tonight. My friends, our regular guest is the editor of Movie City News and the man behind the hotbutton.com. David Poland joins us on the phone from the West Coast this morning. Good morning, David.
Good morning. I'm a little meat scared here.
Are you scared? Are you a vegetarian?
Huh?
Are you a vegetarian?
At 5:30 in the morning, I'm scared of meat, yes.
But do you eat meat?
I do eat meat, actually. I quite like meat.
Yeah, well, I do too, but I haven't been eating it for almost a year, and I slipped. I had some biscuits and gravy.
Well, I'm sure you look fabulous.
Well, thank you very much. What? Now anything you say will be fine with me. So, look, I don't. This is off topic, but not really. I went to see North Country over the weekend. I was up in Vermont and had nothing to do. Mm-hmm. Was that not one of the worst movies you've ever seen in your life?
I thought there was a movie inside of the movie that actually was okay. But I think that there were so many shots of smokestacks spewing beautiful, beautiful smoke. So I was like, okay, what does this have to do with the rest of the movie?
Right, well, didn't you find that, like, okay, so there's a great story there. There's a story there that should move towards some sort of catharsis, but they introduce a story, and then they just go through these weird, hackneyed repetitions of why it's an important story, and then all of a sudden the conclusion happens, and you can't even cry. I expect to cry at a movie like that.
It was kind of a fascinating thing, because on that picture, I wrote a piece about it at Toronto last
year. Mm-hmm.
Or seems like a year ago already, a few months ago.
Yeah.
And you know, wrote particularly about how Frances McDormand's character kind of went from being a very happy-go-lucky person with in her hand,
right,
being in a wheelchair, not moving
in a week,
3 months. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. There's no sense of time in that movie. I know it's old news, so I don't want to dwell on it.
But then I got a note from her family saying, "How can you do this to our mother?" And I'm like, "I'm not writing about your mom. I'm writing about the movie." And you know,
wait, you mean
very upset? But it turns out there was the whole story was kind of twisted around to create the Charlize Theron character as the hero, and it was it was a complicated story to do. You don't really do those kind of movie things as movies.
Yeah, you can't do something and hack it up like they did and just try to make it this tear-jerking narrative. So you got a letter from the family of the person that McDormand was playing?
It was ALS, yeah, and they thought I was dissing their mom, and I was like, one was actually the mother-in-law,
wow,
or the son-in-law of the woman, and one was the brother. And
wow,
it was very nice, and we had a long exchange, actually, about what has happened. And the saddest thing about it was it turns out the same harassment apparently is still going on up there.
Oh, wow. So yeah, it didn't have the effect that it, like a Norma Rae had, or
no,
it didn't elevate.
Pretty brutal situation up there, apparently.
Unbelievable. So okay, let's talk about this last weekend. The slump is over, whatever the slump that you say doesn't exist. There is no slump, right? There's never
been
a slump.
People love the slump. I mean, yeah, it's amazing how everybody in town seems to want the slump to continue. They love the slump.
Yeah, so now Walk the Line pulled in a lot of dough. How much did it make?
Almost $24 million, or over $24 million.
You like the movie?
I love the movie. I think it's a terrific movie.
Now, there were some people, apparently, the daughter of Johnny Cash's first wife was also upset about the way her mother was portrayed in that movie, no?
Yeah. But, I mean, ultimately, that she did apparently, I mean, it was one of the complaints I had about the movie, actually. Really good actress playing her, and all she really got to do was cry and bitch and moan. And I actually said to her, I saw her the other day, and I'm like, you know, I wish you had at least one scene where you had a happy marriage for 5 minutes. And apparently it was in the script at one point, and there was even maybe sex with her husband at one point in the movie. But, you know, they cut it down, because the movie really is about the love story between June Carter Cash and Johnny Cash. And that's really what the core of the thing is. So they got down to that. And frankly, in a film about somebody's life, you really have to do that. You have to make those choices. So, you know, she served her need dramatically in the movie. And sometimes you have to choose reality to take a backseat to drama.
So now let's talk about this Harry Potter phenomenon. The media is saying that that Harry Potter is going to carry the year and make it one of the biggest money-making movie years ever. Is that true? It seems like the response to this latest Harry Potter movie is not as intense or as big as the other ones.
Well, you know, the funny thing is that what's happened is people, I mean, again, this is the reason, one of the reasons the slump is ridiculous.
Yeah.
People are going to see movies in bigger numbers that aren't necessarily as excited by those movies as they used to be.
Right.
So a movie like Spider-Man 2, for instance, did huge business. And did anybody, do you really, you know, think about that as a phenomenon movie?
Right.
Do you think of The Last Star Wars ultimately as having been a phenomenon that changed the summer and whatever?
No. I only saw the first one.
Yeah, well, there you go. You were six at the time.
I know. I mean, I think I saw a few. Yes, I detached from Star Wars at some point. But so how do you think the
Harry Potter, I mean, Harry Potter is, it's huge, but the thing is, every year has those movies mm-hmm. that generate the business. Mm-hmm. You can't say any year without the number changes everything. I think the November, December will be the biggest ever.
Wow.
I think between Narnia and Kong and Home with Dick and Jane and Harry Potter, that this is going to be a huge, huge, huge 6 weeks. And, you know, ultimately, it already is the fourth biggest year in history this year.
Wow. So,
even with all the complaining about the box office, and with this, it may well be the second biggest year by the end of the year.
So let's talk about, let's do a little Oscar talk, because I want to know. I just saw, you saw Syriana, right? Yeah, we talked about it. I thought it was a good movie. I thought it was a little long in some areas, but I thought ultimately, overall, it was a good movie. Did you?
I thought it was a good movie, but I thought it was very dry. It didn't have a whole lot of emotion in it.
What did you think of Clooney and Damon?
I thought they were all very good. I thought all the performances were actually quite good in the picture. I just kind of felt like it was a dramatized hour-and-a-half version of Nightline, or two-and-a-half-hour version of Nightline. There was something not dramatic about it. I don't think you ever really felt emotion about those characters, and it's very hard again to do a movie where you don't have that drama.
So where's the Oscar momentum? What? Because I know some roles were being talked up, and some movies were being talked up, and then some always sneak in underneath. Which ones did we think were going to be Oscars, and that you think are no longer going to be Oscar movies?
Well, movies like Jarhead have fallen off the map. Movies like Good Night and Good Luck is already kind of falling backwards. Even though people love it. It's
falling backwards in what way? Yeah, you mean in terms of...
When it first came out, there was a lot of hype about it being a Best Picture movie.
Yeah.
You know, guaranteed this and guaranteed that, and it just isn't... It's such a small movie.
I didn't love the movie, I tell you.
I like the movie, but it's very, very tiny.
Yeah.
Again, it's kind of like a documentary or a docudrama.
All right, so what's in the lead now?
Munich. I mean, it's still the...
The new Spielberg movie about the Munich Olympics and the... Yeah. And the killing of the Israeli
The killing
athletes.
Of the Palestinians who killed the Israelis
mm-hmm.
is really the core of the movie, and that is still looking like the movie to beat. Memoirs of a Geisha has turned out to be a beautiful, beautiful movie that's not very good.
Mm.
It is one of those gorgeous things you'll ever see and not ever want to take home again.
Now, David, we're hearing a little advanced hype on the new King Kong remake.
Ooh, ooh, ooh. Yeah.
That's exactly it.
What do you know about it?
It's really, really big. It's 3 hours long.
Kong is big.
It's very expensive.
Yeah.
And it's looking better and better and better. I think it's going to be kind of like Jurassic Park. I think actually this is going to be the movie that people get really excited about and have to go back to see two or three times, even though it's 3 hours long, to really get a full taste of.
People are willing to tolerate that from Jackson, it seems, or from the stories, the way he tells them, anyways.
They're willing to go see 4.5 hours of Peter Jackson's work.
So yeah.
It's pretty stunning. I was saying to somebody the other day that if you put together the extended versions of all the Lord of the Rings,
yeah.
it'd be like a 12-hour movie day. Insanity, really.
But my wife would go see it. She loves it.
Really?
Yeah, she's just crazy. You had to grow up with it. I didn't read it as a kid, did you?
I never read it as a kid, but I liked the movies. I always, you know, for me, they were always too long, but had enough in them and had strong enough endings that you kind of stuck with it and it was great.
All right, so what's coming out in the next few weeks that I have to see? I'm going to go see Walk the Line. I want to see that. What else do I got to see?
You should go see Walk the Line. You should go see Match Point when it finally comes out. You should go see, I mean, pretty much all of these movies that are in the Erase. I mean, you don't have to necessarily see Geisha. I think you may want to skip Ian Flux.
And Match Point, the Woody Allen film, is a good Woody Allen film?
It's a very strong Woody Allen film, but it's not funny.
That's okay.
It doesn't feel anything like a Woody Allen film, for a few little points here and there, but basically it's kind of like the dramatic half of Crimes and Misdemeanors.
Crimes and Misdemeanors is a masterpiece.
That is a masterpiece. It's kind of like if you cut that movie in half, so it's a little bit... there's a little sense of deja vu while you're watching it, but
right.
It's a much younger, sexier version.
All right, Dave.
And it's great songs.
Well, it was great talking to you.
Have a good one.
We're gonna get on the phone with Lori David now, and I will have a good time with my mom. And you have a good Thanksgiving.
I will. I'll be getting in my SUV, which I don't really have.
All right, David. Take it easy, David Poland, editor, movie news, Movie City News, and columnist at thehotbutton.com. We're going to talk to Larry David's wife, Lori, in a couple of minutes about what she's got going on. She just produced a big comedy show to raise awareness of global warming, and apparently it's going to be made available in some outlets that some of you might know about, and might not know about. Some of you might know about it. 45 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
This is Cindy Sheehan. Whether I'm waking up in Crawford, Texas, Washington, D.C., or Vacaville, California, I wake up with Mark Maron and Mark Riley. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past. Let's land this thing. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. You can go to www.aol.com/comedy right now to see what we're about to talk about. Global warming is not funny, but often using humor to talk about serious issues gets the message across, as we know here on this show. Last week, a group of comedians got together in Las Vegas to tape the comedy special Earth to America. Earth to America can now be downloaded free from AOL.com. It is the brainchild of Lori David. She is an environmental activist and wife of Larry David. Lori joins us live on the phone from the West Coast. Good morning, Lori.
Good morning, you guys.
Good morning.
You will not believe what we got on the air in primetime television.
I heard it was great. I talked to a couple friends who saw it, and my manager saw it. Said it was awesome.
No, you won't believe it.
What?
I think this is the most subversive thing that's ever been on television.
Thank God. Thank you for doing that.
I mean, this is 3 days later. I can't believe it. Everybody has to take a look at this show. First of all, Triumph the Insult Comic Dog.
Hilarious.
Okay?
Yep.
He goes to Washington, D.C., and he sits down with four sitting Republican congressmen who none of them believe that global warming exists.
Uh-oh.
And this is on the air in prime time. I don't know how these guys are going to go back to their office.
That's great. Michael must have loved that.
It's so incredibly funny. And there are so many great moments
in
the show.
Like, who else was on the show? Tell the people.
Well, we've got Jack Black, Will Ferrell, Bill Maher, Steve Martin, Tom Hanks, Conan O'Brien, Ray Romano, Robin Williams, Ben Stiller. I mean, it goes on. Will Ferrell does a brilliant Bush impersonation. It's just so funny. I mean, it goes on and on and on. Another one of my favorites is Marty Short. Do you remember from the days of Saturday Night Live,
sure,
the Nathan Thurm character?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Sweaty attorney.
The lawyer, yeah, sure.
Well, he's now working for the oil industry.
Oh, it's great.
And he gets interviewed by Bobby Kennedy, and it's hilarious.
Oh, I got to watch the whole thing.
I'm telling you, from beginning to end, you have to watch the whole thing, because Larry starts the show in a cold open.
Mm-hmm.
He's in full costume as Paul Revere.
Oh, good. Okay.
I mean, this thing, you really have to see it.
It's already funny. www.aol.com/comedy is where you can see this. It's through the end of 2005. So what kind of progress are you making with the Detroit project to actually reduce dependency on foreign oil? Something's got to be done. I know you're working towards that end.
Well, here's a headline from the New York Times a month ago.
Okay.
Ford and GM suffer as buyers shun SUVs. So...
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're making some progress. I mean, people, you know, there are things that people can do. I mean, all you have to do is consider a hybrid car or a high mileage car.
And I think the American people are finally getting turned around on that. I'm not saying we shouldn't have SUVs. I'm just saying Detroit should make SUVs that get 50 miles to the gallon.
Absolutely.
Lloyd David, why does it always seem that when the bosses at a particular car maker make a mistake, like manufacturing too many SUVs, it is the workers, in this case to the tune of 30,000 people, that end up losing their jobs?
Yeah, it's unbelievable. But all GM and Ford had to do was make some decent hybrid cars. This has been, you know, I mean, look at Toyota. They are, the stocks are rising, and they're doing great. And the American car companies are doing terribly. They just, they had no vision. And, you know, they kept saying, well, Americans don't care about fuel economy. They don't care about fuel economy.
I'm trying to get someone to design a car that runs on human fat, that they can just put on some sort of fat-to-fuel interface harness as they drive and eat while they drive. Do you think that will get any traction?
I think it might, actually. So, I think it's a really good idea.
Thank you. So you're working also on the virtual march to Washington. Could you explain that to our listeners?
Yeah, well, this is the thing. I mean, for Earth to America, it's not a fundraiser. We're not asking for people for money. The only thing we're asking people to do is to join a virtual march on the internet at stopglobalwarming.org.
Okay.
And that's it. And basically what we're doing is we're marching, and we're going to, you know, in the old days, if you wanted to build a movement and you wanted to tell the government that the people wanted something to happen, mm-hmm. you'd go out in the streets, but it just doesn't work anymore. It ends up as 30 seconds on the evening news.
Right.
So we decide, okay, we're going to do this on the internet, and we're going to do it every day, and we're going to count every single person that joins. So if you go to stopglobalwarming.org, you'll be counted. And we're now over 220,000 people. I think 50,000 people signed up yesterday.
That's a great idea.
And we want to just build this number so big and get so loud that the media and the Congress and the administration can no longer ignore the issue of global warming anymore, and that we get past the debate about global warming and onto the solutions.
Great, and I hear you can win something if you go sign up.
You know what? If you're a college student and mm-hmm. you sign up through MTVU,
uh-huh.
you can possibly win Larry David's Prius.
Now is he gonna sign the hood?
He'll sign anything you want. The car's a mess, so you get it exactly in the condition that he's driving.
Is he gonna leave something in it?
Well, there's all kinds of garbage in it right now.
Larry David garbage?
You can't even, I don't know if other women have this problem with their men.
Oh,
I
yes.
swear there's not one time I get into his car where there isn't 20 things on the seat that I'm supposed to be sitting on. And it all gets, you know, dumped on the floor. I mean, does everybody go through that, or is that just me?
In my relationship, it's the other way around. My wife, you know, creates a nest out of a car. So is Larry just sleeping? Are you sitting there in bed?
Larry is sound asleep.
All right.
I had to close three doors and promise I would whisper. he's very sensitive. He doesn't want to hear anything.
So, best of luck with everything that you're doing. I think it's very noble, and I think it's really making a difference. I appreciate it, Lori.
But listen, you guys, your listeners have to go see this show. They will not believe what we put on in primetime.
www.aol.com/comedy through the end of 2005 if you want to see this amazing comedy festival, Earth to America, that Lori put together. And also it will put things into perspective for you. Thank you so much, Lori David.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, take it easy. All right, there you go. For those of you who are just tuning in, here are some highlights of what we talked about on the program today. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. GM announced it will close 9 plants in North America by 2008, eliminating 30,000 jobs. GM has been crippled by plummeting demand for its big SUVs. A GM spokesman said it was painful to slash so many jobs, but, quote, hopefully smaller is better. Wait, smaller? Better? I just had a brainstorm, unquote. Evangelical pastor Jerry Falwell has announced what he calls a friend or foe Christmas campaign, which will sue or boycott any organization which he feels is trying to put a damper on Christmas celebrations. Falwell said, you know, quote, you know what we call people who don't celebrate Christmas? Jews. And we all know what they did to the Son of God. If it was up to me, I'd lock them all up in a camp somewhere at the beginning of December and wouldn't let them out till New Year's Eve. End quote. The Christmas Project slogan is Merry Christmas, it's okay to say it, and we're pretty flexible on faggot and kike as well. End quote. A South Dakota teen may have to register as a sex offender after being arrested for trying to have sex with a mannequin. If convicted, the youth has to register as a sex offender. Every time he moves to a new neighborhood, he would have to inform all the department stores in the area. Yet. Phrase of the day, just drop it into conversation. Now Dick Cheney is calling Representative John Murtha a patriot. Is Dick backing down from a fight, or is he just seeking a deferment? Wake up, sheeple. If you face him down, a backstabber is helpless.
See you when you get back.
Have a happy Thanksgiving,
happy
Riley.
Happy Thanksgiving. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
I'm David Orrick.